Let's open our Bibles to the book of Genesis. Genesis chapter 37. I'll be reading verses beginning in verse 12 and continuing to the end of the chapter. This is our second week in the story of Joseph, which is the story of the generations of Jacob, the last 10th book of the book of Genesis. We're going to see in this story, first of all, we're going to see things that are familiar. I think all of us know this story. Of course, there's danger in familiar stories in that we might lose sight of what God would have us to see. And so I want to point out to all of us as we read it, as we prepare to hear it read, the way that God's providence shines forth, even though his name is never mentioned in this chapter. That's a tool we've seen Moses use before in Genesis. It's almost as if the chapters where God's name is left out, that those are the chapters in particular where Moses wants to see the hand of God at work. And so hopefully we'll see that tonight. Genesis 37, beginning in verse 12. Let's listen carefully. This is God's perfect word. Now his brothers, that being Joseph's brothers, went to pasture their father's flock near Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." And he said to him, "Here I am." So he said to him, "Go now, see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring me word." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a man found him wandering in the fields, and the man asked him, "What are you seeking?" "I'm seeking my brothers," he said. "Tell me, please, where they are pasturing the flock." And the man said, "They have gone away, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. They saw him from afar, and before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we will say that a fierce animal has devoured him, and we will see what will become of his dreams." But when Reuben heard it, he rescued him out of their hands, saying, "Let us not take his life." And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood. Cast him into this pit here in the wilderness, but do not lay a hand on him, that he might rescue him out of their hand to restore him to his father." So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the robe of many colors that he wore, and they took him and cast him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. Then they sat down to eat. And looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers listened to him. Then Midianite traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. They took Joseph to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph was not in the pit, he tore his clothes and returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is gone, and I, where shall I go?" Then they took Joseph's robe and slaughtered a goat and dipped the robe in the blood. And they sent the robe of many colors and brought it to their father and said, "This we have found. Please identify whether it is your son's robe or not." And he identified it and said, "It is my son's robe. A fierce animal has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his garments and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. All his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, "No, I shall go down to Sheol to my son, mourning." Thus his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. Thus ends the reading of God's perfect, holy, inspired word. We're going to follow our normal pattern. We'll work through the passage. I'll try to stop at certain points so that you can ask questions, or if you have some comments to add, we can work through that together. But we'll try to work through this. I'm not planning to go through this in order, partially because you know the story, so you know what happens, and also because there are some things that I want us to notice about the story and what's being communicated to us. And so I want us to be kind of above the story, looking at some of the details and understanding what Moses intends to communicate to us through it. Now, 2 weeks ago, we looked at the first 11 verses, and what we saw was conflict in the house of Jacob. In particular, conflict between Joseph and his brothers. And we saw that the conflict arose for three reasons in particular, as they were laid out in those verses. First of all, because Jacob favored Joseph. Now, we're going to come back to this some, but you can see, can't you, the sins of the fathers being visited to the children and the grandchildren, right? And Jacob not learning from his own experience. We know that the favoritism of his parents set Jacob and Esau at war with each other. And yet Jacob, for some reason, carries on that same kind of favoritism in his own family. We know the reason, of course, being because Joseph is the son of his favorite wife, who is now dead. And so he favors Joseph. And for that reason, his brothers despise him. We also see that Jacob not only favors Joseph, but he chooses him. This coat that says it's of many colors, that as we talked about it last time, it probably is really a coat with long sleeves. It's significant because it sets Joseph apart as having authority in the family, as being the one who has the birthright and all the rights of the firstborn, despite the fact that he has 10 brothers older than him and at least 4 that should have rights before him. And so it's not just that it's a robe. It's not because it's really tremendously glorious and his brothers are jealous of it. It's because of what the robe signifies. He's not only my favorite, but he's the first in my family. But third, and this is probably the most important and the thing that bothers his brothers the most, are these dreams. Dreams that become significant in the whole story of Joseph 3 different times. We have dreams that come in pairs. And in this particular part of the story, we have those 2 dreams that show, first of all, Joseph's brothers bowing to him, and then Joseph's brothers and his parents bowing before him. And what we see is Joseph is telling his brothers these dreams is an increase in their anger. Remember in verse 4 of this chapter, we're told that they hated him and could not speak peacefully to him. And as we looked at that, it literally says they couldn't greet him. They wouldn't even talk to their brother. And then we're told in verse 5 that when Joseph had a dream and told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. So before, they hated him so much they wouldn't talk to him. And then he told them the dream and they hated him even more than that. And then at the end of verse 8, we're told that they hated him even more for his dreams, whatever that would look like. And then in verse 11, it's not only hatred, but jealousy. They despise their brother. That's what's happening in the story of Joseph. And we see that hatred then lead to action in our passage tonight. They move from hatred to even more hatred, to jealousy, to a murderous plot, to kidnapping, to selling him into slavery, and so despising their brother that they'll lie to their father, knowing that he will grieve the rest of his life because they hate Joseph that much. That's what's happening in the house of Jacob. And that's what's happening to Joseph. And remember, the question that the Israelites would probably be asking as they hear this story is, where is God? Why does he allow the wicked to persecute the righteous? I was thinking about the words of Isaiah 53, verse 10, which speak, of course, of Christ, but certainly could be applied in some way to Joseph. Isaiah 53, verse 10. Yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. He has put him to grief. When his soul makes an offering for sin, he shall see his offspring. He shall prolong his days. The will of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. Now, there are a few things in there that Joseph doesn't do. But in essence, doesn't that sound like what happens to Joseph as well? Crushed, put to grief. And yet the Lord prolongs his days and the will of the Lord prospers in his hand. That's what the Lord wants us to see in the story of Joseph, is the suffering of this man. But the reason for his suffering is that God is preparing him to be the Redeemer and the Savior for Israel. And we see that all the more in the story today. Now, we're going to follow two lines, as I said, not in chronological order, but two lines. First of all, we're going to look at the turmoil in the family of Jacob, a family that I think we could describe as weak, wounded, and dysfunctional. And we'll follow that all the way to the end of the story. And then we'll come back, though, and see God's hand in the whole of the story, how he takes this weak, wounded, dysfunctional family, and even through their sinful failures, he brings about in his great sovereignty salvation. Now, the story begins innocently enough. Joseph is with his father in Hebron. His brothers are tending the flocks in Shechem. Now, we've heard Shechem before in the story of Jacob, right? Does anybody remember what happened at Shechem? Right. We saw two of Jacob's sons slaughtering not innocent men, but men that didn't deserve to be slaughtered. And so I think what we're supposed to understand is that Jacob wants Joseph to check on his sons because he's somewhat concerned that while his sons are tending the flock, that the men of Shechem might descend upon them. And so he wants Joseph to go and get a report of his sons and bring it back to Jacob. And remember, Jacob trusts Joseph to give a true report because Joseph has shown himself to be trustworthy. And so he sends Joseph, and we see already in this young man an obedient servant. Here I am. It's significant if you think about the few other times in the Old Testament where we hear someone responding in this way. We hear Samuel responding to the voice of the Lord, Eli telling him to respond and to obey and do what the Lord asked him to do. That's the sense that we should have of Joseph. This is an obedient son willing to do what his father sends him to do. And so he goes to Shechem to find his brothers. And when he gets there, they're gone. And what we notice about Joseph is not only did he go in willing obedience, but he's going to carry out the task. And so he doesn't go to Shechem and find that his brothers are not there and go back to Jacob and give up. He pursues them. But we see him basically wandering in the fields looking for his brothers until a man comes to him and tells him where to go. Now, understand that from Hebron to Shechem is something like 50 miles that he's already traveled on his own. And then when he tells him that they're in Dothan, that's another 15 miles that he travels because he's been given a task and he's going to fulfill it. Notice as well how this stands in contrast to his brothers. Joseph is concerned. He's a keeper, in essence, of his brothers. He's willing to go as far as he needs to go to check on them, and he's concerned for them. That's not what we see from the brothers, right? They see Joseph coming. They see almost certainly the robe, right? That's intended to set him apart. That's why they can see him from a distance. Whether it's a many-colored robe or a long-sleeved robe, there's something distinct about it that even from miles away, they see him coming. And they don't rejoice. They're not excited that their brother is coming. They've experienced this before, right? Jacob sending Joseph and they do something and Joseph brings a bad report to their father and they're angry. They don't get excited when they see Joseph coming. They see him from afar, we're told in verse 18. And before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. Divided household. Brothers who hate Joseph and come up with a plot, a plan to kill him. Notice what they say to each other. Here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we will say that a fierce animal has devoured him, and we will see what will become of his dreams. This is, in essence, the climax of their hatred toward Joseph. And notice it's focused not on his father's favoritism and not on the robe, although those things anger them. It's focused on those dreams. It's interesting, isn't it? Those dreams, as we saw last time, are the revelation of God. Joseph acknowledges that later. His dreams and his ability to interpret dreams isn't from himself, it's from God. And so they're rebelling not just against their father and not just against Joseph, but they're rebelling against the word of the Lord. And they think that if they dispose of their brother, these dreams that threaten them will no longer threaten them. Now, there's irony and foolishness in the midst of it, isn't it? First of all, to think that somehow by their own hand that they can stop the sovereign plan of God in the life of Joseph is foolishness. But also there's irony in that, in their attempts to quell the dreams of Joseph, they actually serve to accomplish his dreams. Have you thought about that? By their actions to stop the thing that Joseph has dreamed, they're actually an instrument in the hand of God to bring about those dreams to their full fruition. If they simply send their brothers back to Jacob, Joseph doesn't go to Egypt. Joseph isn't enslaved by Potiphar. He's not thrown in jail. He doesn't meet a baker and a butler and interpret their dreams so that one day he'll appear in front of Pharaoh and become the right hand of Pharaoh, at which his brothers bow before Joseph. And so in their attempts to stop the word of the Lord, they're actually fulfilling the word of the Lord. That tells us something about God, doesn't it? His greatness and his power, that even as we run from him and wrestle with him, that he accomplishes his purposes without fail. So we see this divided house. We see these brothers who hate Joseph. In fact, did you notice the extent of their hatred and their callousness toward him? In verse 24, they took him, they cast him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. Did you notice what it says in the very next verse? Then they sat down to eat. Imagine the callousness of that. Their brother, who we learn later, is pleading with them from the bottom of the pit to release him. And they sit above the pit, eating food while their brother starves and wonders if he'll ever see the light of day again. That's the extent of their hatred and their callousness toward their brother. They eat. We learn about two of the brothers in particular, something about them in the story. First of all, Reuben, who we've seen already some of his sinful weakness in sleeping with the wife of his father. Here we see something different. We see him at least attempting to do good, and yet we also see his impotence. This is the eldest brother who should be exercising leadership in the family, but his brothers essentially ignore him. He comes up with a plan because in his mind he knows that it's wrong to kill his brother. Notice, though, what he doesn't say. He doesn't say, we shouldn't kill him. Let's be kind to him and bring him back to our father. He's not brave enough to confront his brothers in that way. He says, no, let's not kill him with our hands. Let's throw him into the pit. And it seems as if the brothers still intend for Joseph to die. But instead of killing him in a moment, they intend to let him starve in the bottom of a pit. Because as we move on, Judah's concern is that he wouldn't die in the pit because then we'd be responsible for the guilt of his death. Let's send him into slavery. So Reuben hasn't stopped the murder of his brother. He's just slowed it down. Of course, with the hope that later he'll be able to return and release him. It seems as if Reuben's doing this because he needs to regain the favor of his father. And yet his plan ultimately fails. He goes away probably to tend the sheep while his brothers remain there eating. And the Ishmaelites come and they send Joseph off into slavery. And Reuben returns and finds the pit empty. Did you notice the strangeness of that scene? Verses 29 and 30. Reuben returned to the pit. He saw that Joseph was not in the pit. He tore his clothes and returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is gone and where shall I go?" And then we're done with Reuben. But there's no answer to his question. You see some of the ineffectiveness of his leadership. What are we going to do when his brothers are, Reuben, leave us alone. But we see his weakness too, don't we? He was upset that he might be dead, but then when he finds out that they've sent him off into slavery, he's willing to go along with their plan to deceive his father and to watch his father mourn rather than to go find his brother and buy him back. And so we see the weakness, the ineffectiveness of Reuben as the firstborn who should be leading his brothers. But we see as well Judah, who is the advantage that we have in knowing the whole story, who is the promised seed. He's the seed of the woman, not Joseph. This is Judah, the seed of the woman, who comes up with a different plan. And we see in Judah the kind of leadership that Reuben can't exercise, the kind of respect from his brothers that they're willing to do what he asks them to do. And yet Judah doesn't come off well in this part of the story. Notice that it says in verse 26 that Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood?" Now, that's not a very good question. The word profit doesn't just mean profit money. It actually means getting money through violence. In other words, what good does it do us to commit violence so that he's dead? Why don't we commit violence in such a way that we'll be richer for it? That's what Judah's doing. Not so much love and compassion for his brother. And notice, it's not that he cares so much about whether his brother dies. It's whether the blood of his brother will be on his own hands. That's what he's concerned about. Will I be guilty before God? He even ironically says in verse 27, "Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and let not our hand be upon him," even though their hands have already been upon him, throwing him into the pit. And now their hands will be upon him again to pull him out of the pit just long enough to hand him off to slave traders. Their hands are upon him. But now they're upon him in such a way that Judah can have some money and be enriched as he destroys, or thinks he destroys, his brother and does, for a time at least, destroy his father. They sell him for 20 pieces of silver. This is the going rate, we read later in Leviticus, the going rate for a common slave of 12 to 20 years old. They get for their brother what they would get for any other slave that they might sell. But there is some more interesting irony in this passage, a foreshadowing, if you will, of what will come when they bow before their brother. The Ishmaelites were told in verse 25, come bearing certain things from Gilead. And it says that with their camels, they're bearing gum, balm, and myrrh. Later in chapter 43, when Jacob sends his sons to Egypt to buy food, he sends them with certain gifts. And among those gifts are gum, balm, and myrrh, which they bring not just to Egypt, but to their brother to buy grain. There's some irony. I always enjoy that humor of God as he foreshadows, even reminds us that in their plotting, they're simply putting in place the plan of God without even knowing it. Now, finally, as we come to the end of the chapter, we see in this dysfunctional family that they are wounded. The brothers in verse 32 send the robe stained in goat's blood before them. It seems as if they're too embarrassed to stand before their father with the robe that they ripped off of their brother and spilled with blood. And so they send it with servants in front of them. And notice how they talk about their brother. Verse 32, "This we have found. Please identify whether it is your son's robe or not. That's significant. They don't say whether it's our brother's robe or not. They don't acknowledge him in that kind of way. We see the same kind of thing in the story of the prodigal son, Luke 15. At the end of that story, when the older son, who is angry because his father's received that prodigal son back, he says to his father, "This son of yours." And his father, in a mild correction, says, "This your brother, not only my son, but your brother." Again, the callousness of Joseph's brothers, that they don't even acknowledge him as their brother, but only the son of their father. And as the chapter comes to a conclusion, we see Jacob distraught and in mourning, overwhelmed with grief, because first he's lost his favorite wife and now he's lost his favorite son. But notice how the sins of the fathers again come to the sons and the grandchildren. Did you notice the irony that in their deceit of Jacob, they use a goat and a robe? The same thing that Jacob and his mother used to deceive his father. And again, the favoritism that Jacob shows toward Joseph that leads to anger and hatred and jealousy, and in his mind, the murder of his favorite son. But notice as well the callousness of the brothers, not just toward Joseph, but toward their father. Verse 35, they see their father in mourning, and they were told that all his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him. The height of deceit, right? Because they had the words to comfort him, didn't they? "He's not dead. Let's go find him. Buy him back." But they couldn't do it. That's the family of Jacob. Brothers who are callous and hateful toward their brother, and ultimately callous and hateful of their father. Hypocritical and deceitful to the last. And a father so torn that he says that he will never put away this grief until he departs from this earth. And yet, in the midst of that family, God raises up a Savior for Israel. And in this chapter, where God's name is never mentioned, we see the hand of God again and again working in and through this family, and even redirecting their sinful, callous wickedness in such a way that he raises up a redeemer. Because that's what Joseph is, right? We looked at those passages last week, chapter 45, verse 7, and chapter 50, verse 20, when Joseph remembers and reminds his brothers that though they committed wickedness, that God intended it and used it in such a way to prepare him to redeem the people of God. And we see it in this story as well. You remember the man early in the story in Shechem. A man found Joseph wandering in the fields. No name, just a man. And yet sent there to redirect Joseph so that he could find his brothers, so that he could be kidnapped and enslaved. If he doesn't find his brothers, he returns safely to Jacob and he never makes it to Egypt. But because this man sent by God appears to Joseph, he finds his brothers, he's thrown in a pit, he's sold and sent to Egypt. God's hand directing. We see him sent to Dothan, a city that we find in another place in the story of Israel. Elisha is with his servant, and The king of Syria sends his army to speak to Elisha, and his servant looks out in the morning and opens the windows and sees a tremendous army surrounding them on the hills. That's in Dothan. And he's terrified. And what does Elisha tell him? Do not be afraid, for there are more with us than there are with them. And then he looks out, and what does he see? Horses and chariots of fire. The army of God surrounding them on every side of the mountain. Now, Joseph doesn't see that army, right? But the hand of God is surrounding Joseph, protecting him, preparing him. We see the hand of God in Reuben as well, don't we? Because if the brothers carry out their plot to kill Joseph, there is no slavery in Egypt. And there's no Joseph to redeem the people of Israel. His plan is ultimately thwarted. Reuben's plan, that is. He's not restored, and he doesn't recover the favor of his father as he intended to do. And he doesn't deliver Joseph to the safety of his father's house. But God uses Reuben to preserve Joseph long enough for this caravan to coincidentally or providentially, of course, arrive from Gilead. And as his brothers sit above the pit, callously eating their bread while their brother pleads for mercy, the Lord brings these Ishmaelites. You caught that, right? Not the chosen seed, the Ishmaelites. And yet God uses these descendants of the rejected child of Abraham to carry the Redeemer to Egypt to accomplish salvation. And he even uses Judah, utilizes his mercenary plot to enrich his pockets, to fill his wallet. And yet he uses Judah's plan to pave the road to Egypt. And finally, at the end of the chapter, the seemingly strange verse that concludes our chapter, we see Potiphar. The Midianites take Joseph, they sell him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. God, in his providence, through these slave traders, brings Joseph close to Pharaoh. Even places him in the house of the captain of the guard, a trusted servant of Pharaoh. And Joseph, in the wisdom of God, exchanges this long robe of authority and position for the cloak of a slave. Becomes the first Israelite to suffer bondage in Egypt. And yet all by the plan of God. Preparing the way for Joseph to rise to a position of authority in Egypt. A position that fulfills the visions that God gave Joseph and the plan of salvation. And it's not just the plan of salvation that's envisioned in the dreams of Joseph. It's a plan of salvation that was told to Abraham back in Genesis 15. The scene where God renews the covenant and appears to Abraham in a vision. And this is what he tells him. The Lord said to Abraham, chapter 15, verse 13, "Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years in Egypt. But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions. As for yourself, you shall go to your fathers in peace, and you shall be buried in a good old age, and they, that being your people, shall come back here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete." This is God's plan that he told to Abraham, to take them out of Canaan, to bring them to Egypt, 400 years of bondage before they enter the promised land. Why does God allow the wicked to persecute the righteous? Jacob's foolish, wicked sons to persecute the one responsible son? Because God has a plan of salvation. And it demands Joseph in Egypt. There's one more thing I want us to see. It's the way in which God prepares Joseph to be a redeemer for Israel. He prepares Joseph as a suffering servant, who by his submission to suffering brings salvation to Israel. Even by his silence in suffering. Now, I know later we're told that Jacob's brother or Joseph's brothers are remembering how Joseph pleaded with them to release him from the pit. But in this story, he never says a word, does he? He silently suffers in the pit. He's brought up from the pit and sent off into slavery. And in this, I think we have a picture of Christ, because Joseph is a type of the Christ. We're told again in Isaiah 53, this time in verse 7, about Jesus, that he was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. And so Joseph, like Jesus, is stripped of his robes and oppressed and silent. And it's through that humiliation that God brings Joseph to a point of exaltation as the one who is the Redeemer of Israel. Now, as we close, what does that tell us? What does that tell the Israelites who were reading the story for the first time? As they're wandering in the wilderness, after enduring 400 years in Egypt and 40 years in the wilderness, preparing to go into the promised land, they could have said, Lord, why? 440 years. You say that we're your people. Why? And then they see the pattern of salvation as God has established it again and again. Suffering and humiliation that leads to salvation and exaltation. All of it ordained and accomplished by God according to His plan. That's the message for us as well, isn't it? Joseph had slavery in Egypt. Jesus had the slavery of the grave. We, the slavery of sin and death. And God, in His good providence and His great mercy, brings us through that slavery, frees us from bondage, and brings us into salvation. And so the question isn't why suffering. Because God utilizes suffering to bring us to salvation. And so in the midst of it, we can know that God's hand is with us as it was with Joseph and as it was with Jesus. And He accomplishes His purposes in and through that suffering. Now, I just realized that I never stopped for any questions or comments. I do that sometimes. I get going. Any questions, comments? Yeah, Eduardo. His strength is made perfect in my weakness. Is that what you're thinking of? Yeah. Absolutely. Anything else? Yeah, Joy.
Yeah.
Yeah. We see later in the genealogies that the Ishmaelites and Midianites intermarried. And so it's probably related to that, but yeah.
It might be that Midian was where they were from.
That could be too. But they're both descendants. I mean, the Ishmaelites and the Midianites are descendants through the line of Ishmael and Esau. You know, so they kind of work through those lines. They're both seeds of the serpent.
Midianites are descendants of
Oh, is that right? Okay, but they do intermarry. And so like in Judges, for instance, we see them intermarried. And so they're living in the same place. They're kind of mixed together. And so the names becomes interchangeable in the rest of the Old Testament. So that's probably what's going on. Right. Jethro.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Jethro is a Midianite, so. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and then Jim.
Just one verse that comes to mind, John 5, 46. For if you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me.
Mm.
I mean, that's just.
Yeah.
Joseph's story is a story of Christ, in a way, the figure.
It is.
Of Christ, and it's amazing how even the brother's wife, when they put it in a pit, thinking that they're crushing his dreams, is the same thing as Satan, you know, on the cross, thinking that, okay, now the Savior is done with, away with
yeah.
God. But that's the very way, you know, him getting the Lord's heal is the same instrument of crushing his
dreams. I know. I love and that picture.
Just, nobody, God always wins.
Yep.
That's amazing.
Yep. It's true. Yeah. Jew.
Yeah, how do those brothers keep that money from their father?
I don't know.
It's not revealed to us, right?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like they're not around that much. They're off taking care of the flock, so they're. And who knows? I mean, they probably could spend it pretty fast while they're out and about. Knowing enough about his sons. It wouldn't take them that long in Shechem or somewhere else to spend that money on things that he wouldn't know about because they wouldn't tell him.
It seems like they lived in their own households too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't think they live directly under his household.
Yeah. Because they all get married and have kids.
And,
yeah.
And today's silver price would be about $240.
Yeah. Yes. Lions, bears, you know. That's what David's fighting. So, yeah. I mean, it's interesting that the animals don't devour him, his brothers do. I do think there's some kind of irony there that, yeah.
And he's just one of those kinds of dead play, you know, by himself.
Yeah. I mean, he would have experience. I mean, David was the same age when he was out shepherding his father's flock and defeating lions and bears. So they would be, that was part of their job as shepherds, to fend off animals like that. So theoretically, they would know how to defend themselves.